I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Talking Leaves. One River by Wade Davis. I like to take a walk after supper in the evenings. One summer night, I was particularly eager to go out and find some high ground. It was a special evening. The sun and the full moon were both overhead at the same time. The sun was about 30 degrees above the horizon in the west, and the moon was about at the same elevation in the southeast. This is a time of much power. I found a good vantage point in the middle of a quiet intersection. I was in front of a house that had a garden full of strange vegetation. I had seen it many times on my walks. I could only guess at the species. As I stood directly in the center of the solar and lunar influences, I felt a presence. I looked down and noticed another man standing in the middle of the street also. It was obvious that we were doing the same thing. We both laughed and greeted each other. He was a rugged-looking person with a godlike beard and a ready smile. Turned out he had a Ph.D. in botany and was a specialist on psychotropic vegetation. We had a spirited conversation in which I learned much. The book I'll be speaking about right now is called One River by Wade Davis. He's also the author of a more well-known book called The Serpent and the Rainbow. That book was made into a movie and is about the voodoo religion of Haiti. Wade Davis is a native of my town, Vancouver, and he probably was a source of inspiration for the man that I met while watching the moon and sun. Wade studied botany at Harvard, and his mentor there was Richard E. Schultz. Wade and a colleague followed in Schultz's footsteps through some of the most remote parts of Colombia, Ecuador, and Brazil. His book, One River, tells about these scientific adventures. The book is a fascinating blend of memoir, field notes, recollections, and history. To all this, add geology, geography, and humor. Mostly, the book is a tribute to Dr. Schultz. If you look at the Latin names of South American species of vegetation, you will find that many have the second name of Schultesi. You will learn the history of the rubber industry. You'll also learn about the critical job done by Schultz for America's rubber program. You will be amazed to learn how much we depend on this commodity. During the Second World War, after the conquest of Malaysia, America had only 3 months' supply of rubber warehoused. Schultz was sent to the jungle by the American government with orders to find new varieties of wild rubber. The book also tells of the brutalities that were inflicted upon the aboriginals of South America by the greedy rubber barons. By the example of Schultz, we learn that it's possible to achieve a dialogue with mutual respect between a Harvard scientist and a medicine man from the Valpace River. You will learn about coca, ayahuasca, yagé, peyote, teonanacatl, and all kinds of psychoactive vegetation. A most intriguing thing, Schultz learns that the aboriginals classify vegetation in an entirely different way than scientists do. For example, there is a type of psychoactive vine in Colombia. According to the locals, it has many varieties, but no differences can be detected by any modern methods of taxonomy. One variety gives you a vision of being a condor, and it is appropriately named in the local dialect. Another variety turns you into a jaguar, and another was described, quote, "It is like being shot out of a rifle that is lined with Baroque paintings and falling into a sea of electricity," end quote. A native can distinguish these different varieties at a distance of 25 meters. Schultz tried many of these substances, and his usual comment was, quote, "I see colors, nothing more," end quote. He did not allow malaria, beriberi, hostile people, bureaucrats, or waterfalls to stop him. He never carried a weapon. I hope you enjoy this wonderful book. Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Talking Leaves. Iron Coffins by Commander Herbert A. Verner. When I was 16, I worked on the construction of a very large house. The carpenter and I always sat on the unfinished second floor to eat our lunch. It had a beautiful view of the mountains, the forest, and the sea. I always sat far away from the carpenter. He was German, and his name was Adolf. My actions were automatic. From the alleyways of Houston, Texas, to the streets of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, my childhood was filled with stereotypes of this vicious enemy. I remember the day Adolf came and sat next to me. He smiled and his eyes twinkled. I noticed he had two big dimples, one on each cheek. I stared at them. Adolf said he was inducted into the German army when he was only 18. Adolf awoke in a trench, stretched his body, and yawned. A Russian sniper put a bullet through his cheeks. A few millimeters higher or lower, and he would have killed Adolf. Adolf's companions abandoned their position and continued to fight in the forest. They were ambushed. Adolf was shot in the leg and his bone was shattered. He said the wind was bitter cold and he could hear wolves howling in the forest. The Germans fled back to the trench and abandoned Adolf. A Russian soldier carried him to the German trench. I listened to his story and my heart began to soften. I felt my mind expand. A few years later, I drank a bottle of wine with a Yugoslavian neighbor of mine. I talked about a friend, a lady I had met who lived in Poland. I mentioned her town, and the man's eyes became wet. He said he fought the Germans when he was 17, World War II. In Poland, he was shot in the leg. His companions also left him to die. A German soldier carried him to a Polish farmhouse. He said he was nursed by a young woman whose face he never forgot. A few years later, I was delivering mail and a man called out to me from his house. I went into his yard to talk to him. He said my hat was the same one in the same style that he had worn in the jungle in Vietnam. He took it and shaped the brim into the military style. He rolled a perfect cigarette for us. He said he was inducted into the army when he was 18 and sent to Vietnam. We sat on his patio and talked. A house across the street was being demolished and one of the walls fell in. It made a very loud bang. My companion threw himself on top of me. We were under the table before the echo had died. If we were 25,000 kilometers to the west, 30 years earlier, he would have saved my life. War stories. I mention them to introduce the book Iron Coffins. It was written by a U-boat commander who now lives in Florida. It clearly illustrates war. War is a spirit that comes on a wind that blows across all time and tries the souls of men. War is universal. The details of war horrify us, and the strategies of war fascinate us. We study the history of war, and we learn nothing. Individuals hold the real teachings. I chose Verner's book for this reason. His story is clearly written. The viewpoint of the author is unique and valuable. He rhythmically shifts his focus from the sea to the progressive ruin of Europe and the disintegration of Germany. Many war stories attempt to demonstrate the futility of war. Verner accomplishes this with no embellishments. The real story is how the commander copes with circumstances and responsibilities. I think the book is philosophical and emotional, but it is honest and clear. We can learn much from a story like this. Mariners are a special breed. The sailors of the Kriegsmarine were extraordinary mariners. I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Talking Leaves. Neither Wolf Nor Dog by Kent Nerburn. Kent Nerburn is a writer, a sculptor, and an educator. His book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, epitomizes education. The book had to be written, and Kent was chosen to be its author. All North Americans should read it. It will initiate a healing process. Healing is a prerequisite to the continued growth and development of North America. The book is not easy or enjoyable reading because of the sad truth. It is a voice of the survivors of a genocide. It is a voice of Native North America. It asks only to be heard. A humble request, but it is a painful story. The narrator is an old Native American. The old man is not lamenting. There's a much higher purpose. It includes everyone. I have Cherokee blood. It's mixed with Welsh, Irish, German, and Swedish. I was not raised in the Native culture. However, I am a perpetual student of this aspect of my heritage. I found Kent's book at a crucial time in my life, and I'm very thankful. It helped me to see that I have been disrespectful to the Native people of this land because of my ignorance. I believe that our planet can continue to exist in a natural way only if modern man accepts the teaching of the dwindling Aboriginal populations of the planet. For this purpose, the true story of the Indian people must be heard, not for the sake of pity or guilt, but to prepare a basis for spiritual healing, a healing that begins when people learn the truth of the Native North Americans. After the healing, Aboriginal people can share their wisdom with the rest of the planet. They can teach people how to respect the planet before it is entombed in concrete and steel. They can teach us to acknowledge the red man. They can teach us to abandon the myth of the noble savage. They can teach us to be proud of our own heritage. Every centimeter of North America is a witness to this truth and has an ancient name. It's time to learn. Neither Wolf Nor Dog is a test. Open your heart. Teach your children. I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Talking Leaves. Monkey by Chang'an Wu. Chang'an Wu lived in 16th century China, and there's not a whole lot of information about his life. His book, Monkey, is very well known in Asia and all around the world. It is a story of the journey of a man known as Tripitaka. He was an actual person, and his real name was Xuan Zang. Tripitaka lived in the 7th century. He's the man that went to India to learn Buddhism, and he brought this wisdom back to China. There are several other main characters in the story. Now, Monkey is armed with a magical cudgel or stick, and he represents the intellect. Pigsy, another character, is armed with a rake, and he represents the physical appetites. Sandy has a necklace of skulls, and he represents sincerity and enthusiasm. These four characters encounter Kuan Yin, Lao Tzu, and various dragons, diverse monsters, and dozens of Chinese deities. By the 10th century, there was a cycle of legends about Tripitaka's journey. From the 13th century onwards, these stories were performed by Chinese actors. Today, they're on TV, and even in cartoons. I recommend a translation by Arthur Whaley. The original book of Monkey is immense. Other translators have tried to include all the episodes. In order to accomplish this, they had to delete huge portions of text, particularly dialogue. Whaley omitted some entire episodes, but he translated the remainder in its entirety, except for incidental passages of verse, which translated very poorly. The resulting book is for a Western reader. This story is an amalgam of satire, folklore, allegory, philosophy, psychology, religion, history, and poetry. It satirizes all bureaucracy. All the deities are the bureaucrats, and heaven is a replica of the ancient Chinese government. I can imagine Wu in heaven sharing a ribald joke with Rabelais. There were many occasions while I read the book when I laughed uncontrollably. One such occasion was the night when Monkey and his crew stayed at a monastery. They drank all the wine in the ceremonial jars and refilled the jars with piss. Monkey was naughty, so a special crown was made for him, a crown that tightened every time he was mischievous. This story is very well written. A reader of any age can enjoy it and learn from it. I dare not tell you what happened when Monkey ate all the peaches of immortality. I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Talking Leaves, Quasimodo, and a Bowl of Eggs. I remember when I was small and just beginning to receive my education via kindergarten and vacation Bible school, that many topics and concepts were presented to me in such a way as to put the focus on how I was supposed to perceive them, rather than to encourage me to investigate and explore their possibilities. Later, elementary school and church going did much of the same, and this carried right through to high school. I must say, it had the opposite effect from that intended. Most of the instructors were like art experts leading a group of tourists through an exhibition for the purpose of interpreting for them that which they are viewing, and thus saving them the trouble of having an opinion. I found that most folks were happiest with this and experienced real discomfort when, however rarely, they might be called upon to decipher things for themselves. In this scenario, the person who can memorize and parrot back the buzzword and jargon-laden interpretation du jour of a blank canvas is hailed as an intellectual, while the person who points out the obvious will be denounced as a hillbilly. From what I could discern by the time I got my two front teeth, there are two kinds of people the world over. Those that want to know things and are willing to use the intellect given them by their maker, and those that choose to have others tell them what everything means. In part, this phenomenon is due to the awe of academia, which is inculcated into the youngster. The valuable lesson of the Wizard of Oz seems to me to have been lost on most of my generation who were fortunate enough to have seen that movie. The foregoing is in no way meant to imply that we do not need teachers and true experts to help us along the way to understanding things. Indeed, we do. But what do we need them for precisely? I would venture to say that the most precious thing that they could give us is accurate, documented information, or to put it another way, clean data. I would like to define my use of the word expert to mean someone who has exhaustively investigated a particular subject and thus has a greater share of data specific to that topic than the average person. If the expert has done their work properly, the student may check all their sources and verify all the data. The boon to the student comes from having all the diverse sources collated into an index that makes for easier examination as regards to the time involved in this process. Just as there is an obligation upon the expert to conduct proper research, there is an equal obligation on the student to utilize their own intellect in assessing the data before them. If a teacher gave a bowl of different kinds of bird eggs to 5 students for them to examine, they should all come away with 5 individual understandings of these items if left to their own senses and not subject to any input from the teacher. Having said this, they would all 5 undoubtedly have much the same things to say about the nature of these objects. This hints at the beauty of truth. It is verifiable at any time by anyone. Thus, we need not fear that each individual seeker of knowledge may incorporate those building blocks into a unique structure of thought. Working backwards, we might take the five unique reports of the students in the example above and sift them down to that which is common to all. Using that as a base, we would be able to conduct our own further inquiries into the topic and have saved precious time in the bargain. This brings us to well-written books by reputable authors. They are powerful resources and can save us much lamp oil and shoe leather. They can never replace thinking, however, and a reputable author, in my opinion, would not want a non-thinker to tout their work. Two of the topics, of the many that fascinated me from my earliest times, were those of history and religion. Alas, it is these two precisely that remain the most nebulous, and partly this is due to the fact that the majority, by far, of those who write on these subjects have an agenda, an axe to grind, or are bullied and bribed to present their material in such a way as to lead a reader to a given conclusion. This is a science in of itself and was perfected long before technology greatly leveraged the effect. If a person was given a bowl of different kinds of bird eggs to examine by a chicken egg farmer and was briefed beforehand upon what they were supposed to conclude from studying them, that person's perception would be much different than if the same process was initiated by an environmentalist out to save the hummingbird or an African bushman with an ostrich egg canteen around his neck. Thus, a child who just goes and gathers a bowl of different kinds of bird eggs and studies them alone may come away with as much useful hard data as any of the aforementioned groups and also be free of their biases. The child will of necessity of being human have his own bias. It cannot be otherwise. If you presented a hummingbird eggshell and an ostrich eggshell to our bushman for making a new canteen, which do you think he would choose? So let us imagine for a moment that books, well written, are like unto bowls of eggs. We should be able to glean from them much basic data that is appealing to common sense and obvious to any observer that glances inside. I would recommend to you three books by one author that deal with the two topics of history and religion. The author is Douglas Reed, and the books are Insanity Fair, From Smoke to Smother, and The Controversy of Zion. The first was written in 1938, the second in 1948, and the third was begun in 1949 and finished in 1956, although the manuscript never came to light until 22 years after that. One book deals with the lead-up to the First World War, and the other deals with the aftermath and build-up to the Second World War. It also served to show the accuracy of Mr. Reed's predictions outlined in the first book, almost like a report card. The final book is an exhaustive, meticulous study on the genesis of Judaism and Zionism and their impact on Christianity and their role in history. Mr. Reed was an Englishman who described himself as, quote, relatively unschooled, unquote. He began work at 13 as an office boy and followed that up with being a bank clerk at 19, at which time he enlisted to fight in World War I. In 1921, at the age of 26, he began working for the London Times as a telephonist and clerk. Not until the age of 30 did he become a journalist in the capacity of sub-editor. 3 years after that, he became the assistant Times correspondent in Berlin and finally was the chief Central European correspondent in Vienna of the same newspaper. He reported from this vantage during the years between the wars. Many of the biggest players of the era, which I know only from newsreel clips, photos, and textbooks, Mr. Reed knew personally by dint of having interviewed them in person or having sat down to coffee with them at cafes in Vienna, Berlin, Prague, London, Moscow, or Budapest. This list includes villains such as Hitler, as well as the nobility, heads of state, and the diplomats of many countries. Added to this first-hand perspective, Douglas also spoke to the janitors, maids, farmers, soldiers, and commoners of Europe, and their presence in his observations of the power brokers serves to ground the entire body of his writings in a reality that at once is translatable to any reader when trying to make sense of their own times or of his. His training as a journalist, his experience as a soldier, his lack of a bow tie, and his own standards of excellence in his work all add up to one of the best bowls of eggs I have ever been handed on the topics of history and religion. From it, I will make my own omelet, and I invite you to do the same. I have long felt that religion and history are artificially joined at the hip, and this condition gives explanation as to why they appear to limp like Quasimodo through recorded history when we try to study one without taking into account the other. The period of the last 2,000 years, in particular, appears to defy all logic when viewed from the singular perspective of historical narrative that we have inherited in our own time. In concert with this, we are confounded by the phenomenon in religious history that a seemingly global trend towards the eventual idea of a single universal deity dressed up in differing robes should be rather suddenly overshadowed by the idea of a singular god acting on behalf of one exclusive group of humans, whether it be to their benefit or to their detriment. Mr. Reed apparently pondered this same conundrum. Through his news career, which predated the first transatlantic phone call, Douglas eventually began to notice that many of his dispatches to his employer were lost, altered, or suppressed. This led him to breaking with the newspaper in 1943. It's important to note that he walked away from them. Soon afterward, he was to enjoy world fame for his books Insanity Fair, Disgrace Abounding, Lest We Regret, and Somewhere South of Suez. The figures of the sale of these books in their day is nothing short of impressive, and I imagine that at one time, Mr. Reed was a so-called household name in the literate world. After 1951, his book Far and Wide was published, which was a book that looked at America through the eyes of an expat Englishman with much experience in independent study under his belt. I am a born American, and when I read that book, I learned a lot from it. Being a North American, I found that I had very different views on the monarchy of Britain than Mr. Reed, but I also learned to cut them a modicum of slack as well. Just a wee, mind you. What followed next was a complete shutting of the doors. His books were banished from bookstalls, publishers refused to speak to him, and the wonderful books already published began to be withdrawn from library shelves and to literally disappear. If you had read his books without knowing about this censorship, I wager that you would have certainly wondered why this was done. Did this finish the man? No. In 1951, he began writing The Controversy of Zion. He was adding the epilogue just before I was born. This book is over 500 pages and is thoroughly documented, sourced, and indexed. It was, clearly, his magnum opus. He knew it would never be published in what remained of his lifetime, and thus it sat on a zippered file on top of a wardrobe in Durban, South Africa, for over 2 decades. The most I have learned about the story of my Cherokee ancestors was from material gathered by a relatively unschooled Irish-American, James Mooney, who was as scrupulous as he was meticulous. After reading a score of books about the story of the gypsies, I found that the most plausible and resonant attempt to trace that story was in the work of a French-Canadian author whose research and findings were endorsed wholeheartedly by the leader of the Romany Chris. Similarly, I feel certain that Jewish people could learn much about their own story from this work of a relatively unschooled English newspaper man who utilized his skills of gathering facts and presenting them in a concise, verifiable format. At all points, Reed allows his readers to draw their own conclusions while precisely articulating those of his own in a spirit of simply wishing to see the lives of all mankind improved. When he opines, the reader is made well aware of this. Also, this book contains the best description of that notorious Texan, Colonel House, that I have ever encountered to date. While not fully plumbing the depths of this shadow man's motivations and likely connections, Mr. Reed is easily savant enough to see through Mr. House's methods, and he presents them to you in a way that a child could easily grasp. As a Texan, it has always intrigued me just how many Texans there are in history's woodpile. I can tell you that the first two books I mention will give any reader a better sense of the modern history of the Western world when added to whatever texts they have read prior, particularly those texts provided in their education. This last mentioned book, however, will take the reader many layers deeper, deeper than most folks in his day and in ours would be comfortable to venture. I will quote here from Edmund Burke, a quote included in the manuscript before me. Quote, "An event has occurred upon which it is difficult to speak and impossible to be silent." End quote.